to start talking about our ongoing Federal Facilities Academy. So Emmy, I'll turn the floor over to you.
Thank you so much, Jean. And thank you to everyone who's joining us today. We're so glad that you could participate in our Federal Facilities Academy. I did want to talk a little bit about the Academy. For those of you who don't know, the Federal Facility Academy consists of 11 webinars, one of which you're participating in today. And it was really originally created to help EPA remedial project managers from other agencies, including our state and tribal partners, to really understand the nuances of Superfund cleanups at federal facilities. Because as I always like to say, they're the same, but they're different. So we get into the nuances here, particularly with this disputes course. If you would like to participate in the entire academy, that consists of taking these 11 webinars, either live or viewing an archived version, which is also an option if your schedule just doesn't mesh with when we're teaching, and participating in the 3-day in-person course, which we have one scheduled for the end of June, but I believe that class is full. We are working to schedule more, and as soon as we have confirmation on those dates, we will post them on the TrainXt website. So definitely keep an eye out for that. If you do complete all 11 webinars and that in-person course, you can receive a certificate of completion that is signed by the director of EPA's Federal Facilities Program, just to be able to show your management that you're really putting in that extra effort to understand the types of cleanups and challenges that we face at our facilities. Jean, I'll hand it back over for you to talk about certificates.
All right. Thank you so very much, Emmy. So I'll just remind everyone, there are multiple ways to receive a participation certificate. And we know that there's a number of classes involved in this full academy. So remember, there are 11 online webinars that we're hosting here through CLUIN, which are open to the public. You can participate by either attending them live or by replaying recorded versions. And then as Emmy highlighted, there is a in-person classroom delivery, which you must participate in person to complete that course. And it's open only to a limited audience of EPA states, tribes, and other federal agencies. Now, that being said, you can receive a participative certificate a certificate of participation for each one of the online webinars, whether you attend them live or replay the recorded version. So at a minimum, everyone can receive credit for up to 11 webinars. And then for those of you who are able and qualify and can take that in-person classroom training, if you complete all 11 online courses and attend the in-person class, you can receive an encompassing academy certificate, which acknowledges that you did all of the courses as part of the series. So with those gentle reminders, Emmy, I think we can head on over to presentation materials to officially begin the presentation content today.
Perfect. Just one second. We're going to pull those up on screen for you all as we're getting ready here. All right. So again, thank you for joining us, everyone. We are going to be going over resolving issues before formal dispute, and trying to demystify what formal dispute is, what that process looks like, in case you find that maybe you're heading that way with your site. So this is presented to you by the Federal Facilities Restoration and Reuse Office, or FFRO at EPA, and also our Federal Facilities Enforcement Office. So just to give you all a better idea, or rather to give me a better idea of who all has joined us today, I'd like to do a quick group poll. Just let us know what type of conflict you have experienced at federal facilities. So you can use the Q&A box to type in, have you had informal disputes, or does everyone agree and, you know, there's never an argument at your site and you just agree on everything? Or do you have really contentious relationships that lead maybe to a lot of informal and potentially formal disputes? So you can just type those in. I'd love to see all the different range of experience we have from people joining us today.
All right. And so, Emmy, I'm starting to see some responses come into the Q&A space. It does look like many of our participants have done informal disputes. There are a few people who have indicated that they have no experience with formal. We do have someone here who's got 30 plus years of federal facility experience as an RPM. So they've done lots of informal, several formal. And then some people are indicating that they've been involved in disagreements, but not to the level of what they would call a dispute. And here's something that I think there are some commenting that they've had these informal disputes or perhaps disagreements, and they're indicating that it was sometimes with state regulators versus other federal agencies. And then some are indicating some have been contentious. Some have, though, been the opposite and actually worked into some really positive working relationships once they were able to get through that informal dispute process.
That's great. So it really does seem like we have the full range of experience joining us today. Honestly, I think conflict is just part of the process and is bound to happen, but we'll elaborate more on that in the coming slides. So before we jump into everything, I want to give you an outline of what we'll be covering today. We'll talk about how to best prepare for dispute at your sites, some tips on communication and resolving disagreements. And then when you get to that point of asking yourself, is this informal, are we needing to go to formal dispute? We'll again talk about some questions you can ask yourself when taking that step, and also demystifying the formal dispute resolution process itself. And that's where our partners in FIO will be helping us out. So let's go ahead and jump into it with just some introduction. Like I had just mentioned, disagreements are going to happen. They're bound to happen because we have different agencies with different missions coming together to clean up these contaminated sites. It can't be helped. And I think it's good to acknowledge there are times when we're all going to disagree with each other. Let's just have a plan in place so we know how to work through those disagreements and address the conflict that arises. Remember, informal dispute is an option that allows project managers at that site team level attempt to resolve a dispute without further elevation. I always recommend the closer to the site work you can come to agreement, the better. I feel as you get up the layers of management, more cooks in the kitchen, that decision may morph into something perhaps an RPM would not necessarily select. So again, closest to the work is best, at least in my opinion, for resolving these issues. And there's benefits from resolving issues quickly as well, right? Especially in cleanup. If we're working in a collaborative manner, that can help ensure there are fewer work stoppages, make sure we're meeting those faster cleanup times and milestones set for the site. And it also reduces having to delay and move back, push back those milestones, which I think most sites have had to come to that where they're looking at the milestones they have in their federal facilities agreement, and for whatever reason, complexity, budget, what have you, you have to push those milestones back. So if we can avoid doing that, all the better. Again, I mentioned that there are different reasons for conflict. We mentioned differing agency missions. That's a big one. Think about it. Federal, state, or other agencies are going to have different priorities when they look at the cleanup mission. So that has to be dealt with. And things like cost or the scope of what that agency is working on. What resources are available? Are these timelines realistic? How clean is clean with these final cleanup goals? It's a lot to consider. And not to mention, outside of just differing agency missions, we can have things like personality conflicts or communication issues that all feed the conflict monster, if you want to call it that. I shouldn't call it that because conflict's okay, right? That it just has to be dealt with. So on this page, I want everyone to take a look at the photo and quickly tell me, go ahead and type it into the chat or the Q&A box, what you see in the photo. Don't stare at it too hard. Just what's the first image that comes to your mind when you look at this? Okay, we have some people are saying they see the horse with the rider, and some people are saying they see the old man, right? So here's a perfect example when we can be looking at the same thing, but see different things. right? And this, I compare this in cleanup work to when we're looking at the same data, but there's a disagreement on how that data should be interpreted. I think that happens a lot at our sites, looking at that same data set and drawing different conclusions and having to work through that. It's not as simple as, well, the data says this. Well, interpretation of that data really is where the decisions are made, and that can be where conflict will arise. Not to mention just plain miscommunication. If someone is looking at this and says, it is an old man, that it's only an old man, I see nothing else, that's what it is. And someone is on the opposite end of that. They know it's obviously it's a horse on a rider. How can you see an old man? You don't know what you're doing, what have you. But if in reality, you're saying, okay, I can see your point that you see the old man, but as you, can you recognize that I see the horse and rider, and can we work out a way to draw the same conclusion from what we're seeing? Just a quick example to help us understand. With miscommunication, I feel that there's a lot of jargon that we use with our different regulations and policy and guidance. And sometimes we could be using the same words, but mean very different things. So that jargon, that terminology can really lead to a misunderstanding between the different representatives. Not to mention personality or communication styles. Some people are very direct to the point. Others like to tell you a story and have a more roundabout way of delivering their message. And neither is right or wrong. It's just different communication styles. So if you're a direct speaker, as that's how I identify, I am very direct, and I have someone trying to tell me a story, I can't deal with it sometimes, or I feel like I can't. So perhaps some of you have felt like that as well. So it's important to understand what each group really means, that they vocalize that for everyone to understand, and then try and get a better idea of how can all our needs based on our different missions get addressed. All right, we're going to go into our next section, and this is really about preparing for dispute. So before there's even conflict on the horizon, how can we be ready to handle those disagreements that are going to happen at some point? So one important thing I would recommend to everyone really is looking at the federal facilities agreement for your site. There will be specific text in there that talks about who can invoke a dispute, making sure that you're trying to work informally first before jumping to formal dispute, the specific procedures that have to be followed, what those elevation timelines are in the process. And it also specifically talks about the groups at each level of decision-making and who the representative should be from each agency that's involved. So very important, read your FFA, know it front and back, especially that dispute section if you feel that is where your disagreement may be going. Here's one example of some dispute resolution language from the Travis Air Force Base Federal Facilities Agreement. So here you can see the first highlighted section talks about that the dispute resolution process may be invoked by EPA, the Air Force, or collectively by the parties representing the state of California as a unit. So the state, EPA, the Air Force, each can begin the process that's specifically called out. And it also highlights that the agreement says that they shall make reasonable efforts to informally resolve disputes at the remedial project manager or immediate supervisor level. So that site team level. Again, the lowest level you can make decisions at, closest to the site work, the better. And lastly, if you look at 12.3, it talks about if a party is going to invoke dispute, that they should issue a written statement of the dispute and to be able to engage with the other parties in informal dispute resolution among the representatives. So putting your stance in writing, which we'll elaborate more in a little bit, is really a good way to understand each other better, clarify any misunderstandings that are there. And it's also specifically written in this FFA. So that is something that needs to be followed. So check your FFA dispute resolution section to see how yours reads. So sometimes we get a question of, well, how do I know if I'm in formal dispute or informal dispute? Like, what are the differences? So here are a few differences that we compare. So informal dispute, like I said, I almost feel like that's the disagreements that happen, the natural course of conversation and discussion that has to happen when you're moving cleanup forward at a site. And typically, this is a discussion that's happening at the project level. You have your EPA RPM, the state, and the other federal agency representatives that are working together on the cleanup. Then you might have other people you tap in on to help that discussion. Maybe you bounce ideas off your immediate supervisor, check in on the history of the site to better understand what would be appropriate for the cleanup decision you're working on. Or maybe you have to reach out very tentatively to subject matter experts, be it hydrologist, geologist, or maybe your legal, just to say, hey, am I understanding this correctly? That way, when you're having those conversations with the other reps, you know what you're saying and you know that it's supported by the rest of your agency. So again, these are just preliminary discussions with legal representatives. I like to, when I would call my attorney, I would be like, hypothetically speaking, if, just so, because I'm not trying to pull them into the front line just yet, right? I'm trying to work it at that lowest level and get to resolution in the simplest way possible. So, you know, hypothetically, what do you think I should do here, attorney? That might be one way to approach it. And if you're having these discussions, you know, bouncing ideas off your internal team and having to come back, as long as you're making progress and moving forward with that decision-making process, that's fine. You keep having the conversations. They may take numerous meetings, or you might be waiting on the results of a technical document, what have you. But when you get to the point where progress is not being made and you're essentially stalled, that's when you have to start considering formal dispute. If you're just not going to resolve it at that site project team level and you're in disagreement and you're going to stay in disagreement, then maybe it's time to consider formal dispute. So formal dispute, just for a preview of what we'll go into later in the webinar, has different levels. So you have your site project team. If it can't be resolved there, then it goes to what's known as the dispute resolution committee. And typically, most FFAs use this terminology, but it might be different in your FFA. So keep that in mind. So you have your DRC, the Dispute Resolution Committee, and that typically for EPA has your Superfund Division Director, your SEMD Director, and then it will have representatives at that same level from the other agencies. And they'll talk about resolution of the dispute. There's a specific timeline that's provided for their discussions and decision-making. And again, if the DRC can't come to resolution, then it would get elevated to the next level, which is the Senior Executive Committee or the SEC. And typically, at least for EPA, our representative would be your regional administrator. So that, you know, basically jumps up to the top of the regional management and would have corresponding levels of management from the other agencies involved in the dispute. And if it's not resolved at that level, then that dispute can be appealed to the EPA administrator. But that's just a preview. We're going to go into that in a lot more detail. So really quick, just to see if you've been listening, we're going to have an apply your understanding. So Jean, could you take us through this poll?
Absolutely. So I'm about to launch a poll on the screen right now. And there should be a new window that's popped up on your screen, allowing you to check a box next to any of the answers that you think are examples of an informal dispute. So you should see four options. If you can't read them completely, you can stretch the Q&A window out or simply read what's on the screen and then select your answers. So just check the box to the left. If you think a difference of opinion where the parties are determining how to implement institutional controls to limit groundwater use until the aquifer is restored. Is that an example of an informal dispute? How about B, resolving disagreement between the lead cleanup agency and EPA on determination of applicable and relevant and appropriate requirements, or ARARs, at the director's level? What about option C? One party wants to use certain technology in cleanup while the other parties want to use different technologies. And then the last option is D, a disagreement between the parties over identifying a preferred alternative in a proposed plan. So check off one or all that you think apply and then hit that submit button. And then we'll be able to take a look and see how the audience has voted. Now, it looks like about half of you have participated. If you happen to be on a mobile device, you might need to hit the three dots more menu at the bottom in Zoom to open up the poll, but you should be able to pop that same panel up and participate. I want to get to at least two-thirds, maybe three-quarters of you having participated. Again, there's no penalty for a wrong answer. We're just trying to check to see what you may have learned in terms of informal disputes. And at this point, Emmy, it looks like about two-thirds of the audience have participated. So I think I'm going to go ahead and end the poll. Maybe just a few more seconds. I see a couple of quick responses coming in. All right, let's go ahead and lock it down and talk about those results. So it looks like most of the audience selected A, C, and D, with some people picking B. What's the right answer, Emmy?
So if you selected A, C, and D, I would agree. Those are examples of an informal disagreement. So if you chose B, if you look at the write-up, they're including a director in that discussion. So you might assume that it's been elevated to that DRC level. But you know, that's not very specific, so no worries if you chose B, but it's just looking at the parties involved in the conversation, or rather I should say the level of management involved in the conversation will help you understand, is it informal or is it beyond that in the formal dispute process. Okay, so this is a natural pausing point, so I'd like to just check and see if we've had any questions come in the Q&A.
Yeah, we did have a question. Someone's looking for an example where another federal entity, such as a DoD member, could you give an example when another federal entity, where they're as the lead cleanup agency, would be invoking formal dispute with EPA or state agencies? They really wanted to know, what would that federal facility be disputing in that case?
Sure. So I can think of a few examples. I think I'll start with, let's say that we're working on an RIFS, a remedial investigation and feasibility study for a site, and you're about to issue your draft over the federal agency. Let's say, you know, the DoD component is going to issue that document to the regulators. After the review process, which is also described in your FFA, after that takes its run, say that EPA and the state believe that a certain ARAR should be included, but the federal agency does not agree that that regulation is an ARAR. So as you're proceeding forward, perhaps you're like, okay, well, we don't agree, but we're in the RFS stage, so we can figure this out later. So kick the can down the road, you get through your proposed plan. Finally, you get through to a ROD and you still have that ARAR question there. And there is disagreement, where the regulators, via EPA and the state, say this should be an ARAR. The federal agency is saying, no, absolutely not. Our attorneys don't agree. And then you can invoke formal dispute once you're to the ROD and you're going to finalize what the ARARs are in that record of decision, you can't kick the can down the road anymore. So I would say, unfortunately, there have been a lot of times where we see these disputes take place closer to that endpoint in the CERCLA process. So I hope that helped as a illustration of one potential way to get to formal dispute. Were there any other questions?
Emmy, the only thing I see in the queue right now are just sort of observations on what informal dispute processes are like in their respective agencies. So some people from state agencies are noting that when there's an informal dispute that's been begun, there are specific timelines at their facilities. Other people have noted that some of the delays sometimes in the dispute process are simply coming from resource or staff shortages in their agencies. And that's sometimes why these processes can take a while.
Yes, definitely. We'll talk in more detail about timelines later on in the discussion. So we might have more comments on that. But let's go ahead and continue on.
Oh, we had one more quick question that just snuck in. So one of our students asked, I thought you always had to invoke informal dispute first, and then you could elevate to formal when and if an agreement could not be reached during that IDR. Is that true?
Again, look at your FFA specifically for the language to identify if that informal dispute has to be identified in writing. These FFAs were written over a number of years. They don't match specifically, especially the first ones that came out after 1986. So I would say look at your FFA. It can vary from site to site depending what that document says.
Okay. All right. I think we can carry on. Thank you.
All right. And we'll have time for questions later. If you have additional ones, feel free to put them into the Q&A. So again, we want to talk about preparing for dispute, not when you're already arguing, but before you get there. So developing the relationships that you need to be able to handle these disagreements. So it's important to identify your project team in advance. You're going to know from your federal agency partners who you're working with, if they're state, tribal, potentially other team members, like other state governments that are participating, who is sitting at the table. And from those groups, who is your main point of contact? It might also be helpful to know who to tap on for that technical subject matter expert input. If you're looking at a groundwater cleanup, maybe you want to have your hydro somewhat on standby so you can ask them questions as these issues arise. But you want to do that in advance so you're not cold calling your subject matter expert saying, hey, I need you to look at this. And they're like, man, I'm booked for the next 4 weeks. Develop that relationship in advance so when you reach out, you'll likely get an answer in a more timely fashion. Also, building relationships across the team. It's great to know who you're working with, but you also want to maintain contact with them, meeting regularly. Can you meet in person? I know with the pandemic, that's been harder as of late. Some of you may be returning to the office and engaging in meetings. So when it's possible and safe, definitely try and meet in person. And encourage everyone to speak openly about what their agency's needs are. You don't have to hold anything close to the chest, right? This is top secret. Let's talk about it openly. If we know what we're dealing with and what the needs of each group are, it'll be easier to identify how we can move forward. Another thing I highly suggest when you're having these in-person meetings, specifically if they're centered around a technical discussion, be it around a document or sampling or whatever it may be, always have a very clear agenda on the topics you're going to be discussing at that meeting that is shared in advance so you can have the right people in the room. Don't you hate it when you're in a meeting, you ask a question, they're like, oh, we don't have our expert on that here today, so we're going to have to schedule another meeting. I mean, at that point, you're like, well, I thought that's what we were discussing today. And that's when you've had that clear miscommunication on expectations. With that agenda, like I just mentioned, you can make sure that your key people are present. And are they the decision makers? With EPA, we're relatively flat. The RPM can generally speak to their immediate supervisor very easily. But depending on your state or federal agency or whatever government group you're with, there could be multiple layers between you and your manager or the manager that has a decision-making authority. So making sure you have the right people in the room or setting the expectation of, hey, folks, I need to get briefed, but the actual decision-maker is not going to be at this meeting. I'll need to brief them and get back to you. At least if you let the group know, then you can set those expectations. But when you come to a meeting trying to make a decision and the answer is again, oh, I have to go talk to my management, that can be really frustrating. So make sure you have the right people in the room for the clear agenda items that you've identified. So switching gears a little bit to communication. Okay, so we've talked about identifying who your point people are, maintaining regular interactions with them at meetings, but also just regular communication outside of meetings, be it through phone calls or email. You're really trying to get to the goal where every team member is very comfortable just picking up the phone, calling, your counterpart and saying, hey, I have this quick question, or hey, can you remind me of the schedule? or you want to get there. If it's a contentious relationship and you're not able just to shoot off a quick email or pick up the phone, that likely is going to make it more difficult to resolve issues when they do arise. Also, keep in mind that there's a lot of flexibility in the cleanup process, and it's important to acknowledge that there are multiple ways to achieve the desired results for your cleanup. So avoiding the idea that there is a single right answer, a single silver bullet that will be the remedy that is fully protective of human health and the environment. Often there's more than one answer. So just keeping that in mind, where are the flexibilities? Where can we collaborate and work together to move this project forward? All right, another thing, teamwork. So we're talking about these relationships, building them up, reaching out, and really trying to work together, like acknowledging other ideas that are presented. Even if you don't initially agree with them, like talk it out, encourage people to share their ideas. Then you can better understand where they're coming from or what lens they're viewing the issue through. And that usually leads to better understanding and being able to resolve some issues. If it's an out-of-the-box idea, hey, let's look at it. It might work. Let's talk it through. And again, if compromise is possible, look at that compromise. See where the flexibilities are while still meeting the needs and requirements of your group or agency, but moving cleanup or decision-making forward. All right. So I believe John is going to take over at this point. So while we're switching speakers, I just want to pause and see if we have any questions we could answer right now, Jean.
We had a more sort of observation or commentary. And then there is still a question that's sort of outstanding when we have another federal agency that's trying to initiate the dispute. So I guess I'll lead in with that. Someone noted that doesn't the federal facility have control over what is in a draft final document? And it would then be up to the regulators to dispute the content. They go on to say that they're confused on what a federal facility would be disputing if they have direct control over the content in their documents. And they're noting that maybe they don't fully understand the concept entirely, so it could be their own confusion.
Sure. So if you have that situation and you're like, well, that federal agency is going to issue their draft final document, but ultimately you need to get to a final document, right? So that's where all the agencies who are signing on to that cleanup decision need to be in agreement. I've seen a lot where you're at that RIFS stage and you kick the can down the road, like, oh, we'll settle the ARARs later. We'll settle the to be considered later. We'll settle that cleanup level in the record of decision. So, okay, you finalize the RIFS, you go out for public comment on your proposed plan with those items not quite agreed to yet. But when you get to the record of decision, yes, that other federal agency may draft it, but when it comes to finalizing it, EPA needs to sign off on that record of decision. And at times the state will also choose to sign off on it if they concur with the remedy that's been selected. So I believe that's where it would arise, where the federal agency might say, no, we don't agree with these. I'm just focusing on ARARs because I think that's a very tangible item to focus okay. on. But yeah, that's the point where you would, that, oh, if the federal agency may say, no, we don't agree, and we're going to dispute this, we're going to take this up the chain of management as high as we need to go.
Okay. Okay. So someone asked, would an example of a lead federal agency dispute occur if you had an NPL site where EPA adopts its decision over the agency's decision? Is that an example?
I'm sorry, Emmy, this is Logan. I'll be presenting later, just so everyone on the phone knows who I am. I think that one, I'm going to be talking more about formal disputes later in the presentation. And okay. and it may be helpful if we go through that first, and then I would invite anyone who has those types of questions, certainly let's have you re-ask them then. I think that might work.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay,
Thanks.
that works. Then let me circle back to some of the comments. One of our attendees noted that at their monthly RPM meetings, they actually reserve time to discuss issues or concerns. So this is part of a regular part of their interactions. And they note that these have been really been productive. And most of the time, the issues are just simple misunderstandings. So because they set aside time to have that conversation, they can kind of get ahead of the issue before it really develops.
Oh, that's a great example of planning ahead, knowing there's going to be things to work out. That's great.
Okay. And then someone just added a comment here, and I'll just share this one, that they've faced some challenging situations when their federal counterparts serve multiple roles. So let's say you have someone who's both a project manager, but is also a employee manager, like a section chief. And they don't know a lot about the technical issues that are being discussed. And so that lack of technical knowledge and multiple roles in the project can just make it really difficult to communicate and work. And I don't know if you have any observations on that statement.
No, I think that's a great observation. When you start going up that chain of management, you're getting further away from the technical experts to, you know, people who write not have a technical background at all. So that's really important to keep in mind.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I think in the interest of time, we can carry on.
Great. So everybody, my name is Jonathan Sill. I'm in the Federal Facilities Restoration Reuse Office, and we're going to go over communication and some helpful tools we identified that can help, hopefully help resolve disagreements. Next slide, please. So the first thing we're going to go over is active listening. Active listening is when you actually make a conscious effort to hear and most importantly, understand what another person is trying to say. This requires you to focus on the person that's speaking and not be distracted and immediately forming counterarguments or other conclusions. When you're actively listening, it's very helpful to, give gestures or verbal cues that you are listening, shaking your head, saying, okay, helps the other person who's presenting their point know that you're actually listening. So it's very important during this phase that each team member should have the opportunity to speak and be heard, especially when there's a disagreement. Everybody's entitled to their own, opinions and thoughts. So this can definitely be a proactive way to combat misunderstanding. It's very important that you do not interrupt each other. And again, everybody has the right to voice their own thoughts. Next slide. Another helpful tool is repetition. So repetition is actually repeating what the other person is stating or, giving their opinion. So reiterating another person's statement can help solidify amongst parties by opening a discussion of interpretation. And this also helps to see whether you actually understand what they're trying to say. Typically, there's always misunderstanding between verbal argument, not arguments, but verbal discussions. So helping repeating their opinion in your own words can help to determine whether you understand what the other party is saying or not. Typically, a lot of times misunderstandings occur when you have a verbal discussion. So one way to avoid that would be to have both parties write their opinion and positions and get that in writing. Next slide. Your behavior during this whole process is also very important. So focusing on pertinent issues at hand can be a good starting or correction point for a dispute. Oftentimes when you have an issue, that can easily spiral down into multiple issues down the road. At this point, focus has been lost and is most likely that an efficient resolution will be, delayed. It's important to avoid creating a list of issues that may or may not be related to the current issue. You want to resolve one issue at a time. A lot of times people bring in past baggage and that can be troublesome. So definitely let go of issues addressed in the past, no matter how you feel that how they were resolved and focused on the main issue at hand. Your etiquette is very important. So everybody needs to be respectful in this phase and you should make an effort to take a look at the problem, letting go of past baggage and moving forward. next slide. So we're going to have a quick apply your understanding. Jean, can you get the poll ready? Jean?
I apologize there. I had a click off over here on my end, but it is now resolving itself. Thank goodness. Alrighty. So I'm going to hit share on these and let's go ahead and pop up that new floating window. So in this case, we have a question asking which of the following is not an example of practicing good communication across a site team. Now, this case has four options again, A, B, C, and D, but you only pick one for this question. So click the circle to the left of the answer that you think is right. So is it providing a written summary of my agency's understanding of an issue in our stance? Is it B, asking clarifying questions once another team member has presented their thoughts on a topic? Is it C, raising issues that are not relevant to the discussion? Or D, disagreeing with someone from another group and explaining why I disagree? Now, it looks like, it seems like that ghost is still here. Ah, there we go. Oh, I apologize, but we've got it working now. And oh, you were waiting for that. All right, I can see these answers coming in very quickly. I apologize for that quick delay, but your answers are coming in. Remember, just click the circle to the left of the answer that you think is right, and then hit the submit button. Looks like about two-thirds or so of you have indicated your response. And I do note that some of you had commented that you couldn't answer. You should be able to answer now. If you've chatted in your answer into the Q&A, that still counts, but remember I've got the window open. So I'll give you just a second more to get those answers in. And I'm hitting the end button. 3, 2, 1, now. All right, now let's take a look at those results. And Jonathan, it looks like most of the audience selected C, but there were a handful that looked at A, B, and even some who picked D.
Right. So C is the correct answer. It's not a good example of good communication. Again, you want to focus on the main issue at hand. You don't want to bring back, you know, relevant topics that were, you know, previously addressed. Just focus on the main issue. So that's why C is correct.
Hey, John, I'll jump in here just for a second. And I did just remind people, our cleanups, especially at federal facilities, can be so long, decades worth of cleanup. And you might be working with the same set of players, potentially over years, decades, if you stick around long enough. So when we talk about that laundry list or bringing up old baggage, man, have you been at a meeting where you're all there to talk about X and then someone brings up Y that was resolved 5 years ago, but they're still upset about it? And like the meeting just goes off the rails and there goes your productivity for the day. I've seen that happen a lot, unfortunately. And that's why we're honing in on that quite a bit. Like if it's been resolved and you didn't like it, well, that's in the past. Let's move forward. Back to you, John.
Thanks, Amy. All right, so let's move on. So we're gonna go over resolving disagreements now. First step is to prepare for a resolution. So part of, you know, resolving disagreement, you need to acknowledge that there is a disagreement in the first place. People often ignore the first signs of disagreement. And as Emmy said, a lot of the times people think that, you know, you kick the can down the road and, you know, we'll solve it down. We'll resolve this later. But no, if what you think might be a disagreement pops up early, you should definitely address it at that point. When you come with a disagreement, you need to discuss the impacts of it. Can this disagreement cause issues down at the facility? Are there going to be cleanup delays, you know, that will mess up the cleanup timeline? Are there going to be additional funding that's required and, you know, that's not in our budget that we received this year? I've seen this happen a bunch of times on some of our sites. And is there the potential for formal dispute? Again, we're going to go over the difference between, you know, the informal and the formal dispute phase, but that's something you want to consider. When you prepare for resolution, you want to make sure that everybody agrees to have a cooperative process. You don't want to be in a situation where, you know, everyone's fighting with one another, tempers are high. You want to make sure everyone's able to communicate and get their thoughts across, you know, fairly. You know, you want to do active listening and repetition, just like I mentioned earlier. You definitely want to keep the communication open down the line. Next slide. So you want to, step two would be understand the situation. Everybody's aware that there is going to be varying viewpoints out there. You know, everybody has their own agenda. Each agency has their own mission. So we need to all understand that and respect that. It's important that each group should clarify their positions, and you want to avoid assuming that there's only one way to do this. So we have a scenario over here, and it's regarding remedy selection at a site. This is a completely made up scenario, but I'm pretty sure we've all might have encountered this somewhere down the road. So Alpha believes that the groundwater plume should be remediated through a pump-in treat. Beta believes that the contaminated groundwater should be addressed through monitored natural attenuation, and Gamma believes that more data is needed. So next slide. What you want to do in this situation is clarify the issue in the dispute. List out all the facts, assumptions, and beliefs. Some questions you might want to ask is, what does each person or group believe? What is their motivation? What information is being used to base these beliefs? Here we have more information from Alpha, Beta, and Gamma now. So Alpha believes that pump and treat is best because it has worked well in other areas of the site with similar contamination. Beta believes that MNNA is appropriate due to relatively low concentrations of contaminants, and Gamma believes more data would be helpful. So in this case, it might be helpful to break out into smaller groups and analyze the situation further. There could be where there's too many cooks in the kitchen and everyone's giving their own opinion. So when you brief management, you might want to have, you know, smaller groups and discuss, get clarity on what is needed and convene, and then discuss with the larger group further. So in addition to listing the facts and assumptions at one stance, a good discussion would require all agencies involved to ideally meet their minimum needs, and where flexibility is not possible. Justifiable reasons for limits can be, but are not limited to, laws, regulations, or budget. Personal beliefs should not be a deal breaker or a flexibility issue, and this can be conflicting with a person's agency's policy and guidance. Region agreement will also require identifying issues and offering suggestions. It's helpful if all agencies involved participate and propose ways to issues that can be addressed, particularly the agency that is raising the issue. We all know that there's multiple ways to reach an agreement, so definitely be creative. One way you can be creative is, you know, use negotiation, which, you know, you reach an agreement and make sure that when you come into an agreement that it's all fair for all the agencies that are involved. Open discussion is also a useful tactic, as long as everyone's willing to participate respectfully in this. Discuss your issues with third party people from your agency. There could be experts outside your office that you might want to check in on, and they could also help to see whether, you know, they agree with your position, or if they can see where, you know, the other agencies might have a point. So consider getting expertise advice from your technical experts, your scientific experts, and your legal experts. They're there to help you. So feel free to reach out to other people in your agencies that you might have questions for. And when needed, you can always use like a third party facilitator. These would be neutral entities that assist in communicating and identifying paths forward. I've been on sites where, you know, agencies have used a facilitator, one of their consultants, to help facilitate the meeting. That way it kind of helps, you know, drive the meeting and you identify goals. Sometimes tempers and positions can be heated down the road. So having a facilitator to help, you know, resolve that can definitely be helpful in the long term. And don't forget, once you come with an agreement, you should celebrate it. Everybody gets lost in the weeds. You know, everyone, when there's disagreements, everybody gets upset, tempers flare. So when you guys come to a resolution, always make sure that you celebrate that. Okay, do we have any questions regarding those two sections?
Sure. We do have a question where an attendee noted that they have experienced a lot of turnover with the federal RPM at the site where they've been working. So I think this is their third RPM that they are interacting with. And they say every time this transition is happening, they essentially are starting the dispute process over again, or it feels like they're going back to the starting point. And they wanted to know if there's something that could be done to handle this type of a transition in a more efficient way.
So I'll provide an example. I believe it's at Cherry Hill Point, if I have the site name correct, where they established a communication plan between the agencies on how they were going to go through this process of resolving disagreements. So when a new person came on board, they would be made aware of that and could get up to speed on how the group functioned to resolve issues. When it comes to understanding the technical aspects of a site, that really, you know, falls to that agency and that representative to read the documents and get up to speed. That not much we can necessarily do there besides reminding them it would be helpful if they read the documents for the site when you have that turnover. But your group, if anyone's interested, we can share that communication plan that was used very successfully at Cherry Point, and perhaps it's something you could establish at your site.
Okay. And Jonathan, we did have a few people who I think must have worked with you because they just wanted to say hi. I think perhaps we can probably carry on. Logan, I know that you had noted you might be highlighting some information, and we'll circle back to some topics and earlier questions as well. So I'll turn it back to you all to carry on with the presentation.
Yeah, so this is Logan. I think I can take it from here. So thanks to you all for joining, and thanks to Emmy and John and Jean for getting us all set up. So I'm Logan Senak. I'm an attorney in the Federal Facilities Enforcement Office here at EPA headquarters. So FIFRO, where John and Emmy work, does the programmatic items, and FEO, where I work, does the legal enforcement items. So far today, you've heard from John about all the different ways to communicate and hopefully actively listen and work on issues before we get to a point where we're stuck, all of us. And Emmy provided some great early background too on disputes. So you've heard a little bit about the steps of a dispute and who's involved and how this works. But we're not gonna leave the conversation just there. So I'm here today to talk about what happens if you're really stuck, right? If informal dispute is not successful, if it doesn't work, what happens next? We'll go into some additional detail about those steps that Emmy mentioned. And you'll hear me say a few themes several times because they bear repeating. Sometimes the parties just can't agree. There is sometimes this concern, oh, we've failed to agree. Well, I'm here to say, sometimes that's appropriate, right? If your agency has said we cannot agree to X because of XYZ, for whatever reason, for whatever circumstance, it may be very appropriate for you to say, formally, we don't agree with that, right? So I should also make clear, I'm not gonna provide legal advice today. I know some people might have very specific questions about your site or particular items or particular clauses. I can't get that specific, but I am gonna point you to general resources, general examples. So not legal advice, but hopefully materials that will be helpful to you. And so I would just recommend, don't put those very specific questions in the Q&A chat. And then to the folks who had questions earlier when Emmy was speaking, if you still have them after my stuff and after we wrap up, please ask them again and we can be sure to at least try to get to your question. So with that, let's get started. I think we can go to the next slide, please. So every time you see this little icon, I've sprinkled it throughout my presentation. It's just a note to me and to you to just reference, read your FFA. So we've got a little icon with a document with a signature X here. Your FFA governs your site. It's worth repeating because so many questions about what to do next people have already thought of, right? As Emmy mentioned, some of these FFAs are 20, 30 years old, but guess what? A lot of them, almost all of them, I don't want to say all completely in case there's one I haven't seen, but they're going to have a clause about what to do if you don't agree. They're going to have a clause about what you do for funding. They're going to have a clause about what you do for data sharing. It's probably in there. So check yours, because yours governs. I'm going to use some examples today that are general, right? There are a couple FFAs and some language that's fairly standard, but yours might be different. So give it a look. Next slide, please. So we talked a little with Emmy about, you know, what the difference is between informal and formal. And there is no simple one hard and fast rule, but there are some general ideas. So if you are at the point where tangible progress has really not been made, right? You've met with the other party, you've met at the staff level, you've talked to your supervisor, and you are stuck. It very well may be time to have a formal dispute. The standard timeline for an informal dispute is generally 30 days. It might be variable depending on the FFA and the issue, and I'll show you some text from an example so we can talk about that. But again, you know, you've heard me say it once, I can count them, I'll say it again. Informal and formal disputes are anticipated. This is fine, right? Neither resolution or not resolution is inherently bad. It doesn't mean there's a failure, it means you don't agree. That's fine. Initiating a formal dispute is the appropriate action when no further action can be made at the informal level, right? So we don't want these cleanups to get stuck. We don't want things to drag on for months or years or decades, you know, God forbid. We want these items to be resolved so that things can move forward, the site can get cleaned up. That is the end goal, right? The end goal is a cleanup. So, you know, I think it is just really important to acknowledge if you're stuck, you're stuck. That may be the way things go. Next slide, please. So to help you, there is a principles memorandum that was developed by two of EPA's assistant administrators in 2018. I think the title of the memo is lengthy, but it covers exactly what it's about. Principles for Reinforcing Federal Facility Agreement Informal and Formal Dispute Timelines. So this memo is a reference to you. You'll see in your participant guide, there are some links that will get you to this memo on our EPA website. You can also visit fedcenter.gov, where we have a lot of resources about this, about other items that will be relevant to disputes. This document goes over a few basic principles. There are six of them, but I've kind of combined and we'll highlight three of them here. Again, disputes can be normal. That's time number three I've said that. All parties should have a common understanding of dispute resolution procedures and should resolve disputes informally when possible. And this is something that Emmy mentioned. You know, the folks at the staff level know their site, know their FFA, know their resources, know the partners, know the data, know the circumstances, and they're often in that very best position to know the details. So if you can resolve it there, that's great. Do it there, problem solved. But if you can't, informal disputes should be elevated when the progress has stalled. Dispute resolution timelines should be followed to the greatest extent practicable. That's laid out in the principles memorandum. And each party to the FFA has a role in this, right? This is kind of a communal responsibility from all the parties who are in that document, in that agreement, to work towards this goal. And you'll see the little icon there again. Your timelines are going to be laid out in your FFA. So check them there. Next slide, please. So before engaging in formal dispute, and Emmy hinted at this as well, but it bears repeating, does this issue merit the involvement of upper management? If this is a technical issue over data interpretation, it may involve upper management, but maybe it doesn't. Maybe it's best resolved at the staff level. If it is an issue of national policy, where things are going to have a nationwide effect on all your sites, maybe it is an issue for upper management. No, it really depends. Those are examples, not exclusive. Is it a technical issue that's better resolved by subject matter experts and at the team's level? Same deal there. Have you selected or have you followed all flexibility in finding a path forward? Is there a middle ground that is acceptable? Is there another option that nobody's thought of that is acceptable? You know, these kind of go to the items that John mentioned, right? We all love to say, oh, yes, I've listened and I've heard the other party. Have you really? You know, have you really sat down and said, let me try to understand? That's important. Is there a key disagreement on how this dispute would affect selection of a remedy that would be protective of human health and the environment, right? That's the bottom line. That's the healthy, safe, protective cleanup. That's the goal. So that's really the item to remain, you know, in focus throughout all of this. Next slide, please. So let's say you're really stuck. Let's say it's time to elevate. Let's say it's just, that's where you're at. Again, that's okay. Most of your FFAs are going to require this to be done in writing. I've provided an example in text here. This is our Fort Eustis FFA, which serves as a model for many of the ones that came after it, though not, of course, for the ones that came before. So the icon, again, check your FFA for details. But it will probably say something like this. Within 30 days after, one, issuance of a draft final primary document pursuant to Section 10, your section number may differ, of course, or two, any action, okay, it says any, very broad, any action that leads to or generates a dispute, so we have a very, very broad clause there, the disputing party shall submit to the DRC a written statement of dispute setting forth the nature, the work, and the disputing party's position with respect to the dispute and the information that the party is relying on to support its position. So I really want to emphasize, I think some people are apprehensive of this. Maybe it seems a little daunting. Maybe it seems a little intimidating. Maybe it seems like extra work. Oh, I gotta write this thing. I would encourage you to think of this as a really golden opportunity for you because you get to write it down. You get to find an opportunity for progress because you get to put a fine point on the issue. Here's where we don't agree. We don't agree on X because why, right? Whether it's the data, whether it's a policy thing, whether it's a whatever. And you get to explain your reasons. And so I think that that is very powerful and very important. And rather than perhaps the trepidation that would say this is this first step in a very long process that is very negative, you may very well resolve your issue right there because the other party says, oh, now that I see the way you've explained it, I don't agree, but I can at least see where you're coming from, or I do agree, right? So you'll see a note in your participant guide on the exact terminology for dispute resolution process will vary depending on the language used. Of course, that applies to this slide and all the other slides about this topic. But you're going to have something like this. It's going to look generally like this. And I would encourage you to think of it as your chance to just explain. Next slide, please. So Emmy already covered these, so we won't harp on them unnecessarily, but most of the FFAs, if not all, again, you know, see yours for details, will have a first step, which is a dispute resolution committee. It's going to be your Superfund and Emergency Management Division Director. It's going to be your Federal Facility Manager, some official from the state's environmental program, if the state's a party, right? So some FFAs, states are a party, sometimes they're not. See yours for details. You know, this is kind of your middle management, for lack of a better term. It's probably not going to be your staff because your staff has indicated we have an intractable problem here that cannot be resolved staff to staff. It requires a managerial decision. And so at this stage in most FFAs, you're going to have 21 days to unanimously resolve the dispute and issue a written decision. Now, again, the goal here is let's get this site cleaned up. So we want the decision to be unanimous because we want it to resolve the problem. And then we're going to write it down and everybody's going to sign it so that we all know what has been agreed to and there's no more dispute, right? We've fixed it. We fixed the problem and we want to move on. And so that is really important. If it's not resolved or if it's not unanimous, right? Someone says, I can't agree to this. I don't agree to this. Then you've got, usually it's about 7 days to forward it to what we call the Senior Executive Committee. Next slide, please. So that SEC is going to get the written statement of dispute, that one that you may have written, you know, some time ago, you sat down and wrote, here's what we disagree on. It's going to be a generally group of senior executives at EPA. This is going to be the regional administrator, right? So this has risen fairly high in the agency. I think it's safe to say if we've got the regional administrator on an executive committee, corresponding officials from other federal agencies in the state. It's going to be like often the director of a state's environmental program, right? So if you can resolve the issue before this, you should, because then these are also very busy people. There's a lot going on here, right? There's no need to raise an issue to them unless there is a need. I know that sounds circular. So the SEC is going to have 21 days in most FFAs to unanimously resolve the dispute and issue a written decision. You may see some repeated language here, right? The idea is we will all agree, we will write it down, we will all sign it so that we know what we've agreed to and we've resolved this issue. But if there's no resolution, which can happen, right? If it's really stuck, there are clauses in your FFAs that will provide for further actions. Next slide, please. So if that dispute is not resolved by the SEC, it goes on to the EPA regional administrator, and the regional administrator is empowered to issue a unilateral written decision, right? So EPA is the regulator here. We would issue the written decision that says, here's how I resolve this. If the other parties don't object, if that decision is acceptable, it becomes the final decision. If they do object, the decision goes to the EPA administrator, right? So that issue would be raised to the EPA administrator for a final decision. And you can imagine at that stage, there are a lot of briefings, there's a lot of discussion, right? That can add some burdens, but it also is the last resort. This is resolution of last resort. So in the history of the program, in the history of these FFAs, in the past 30 years, there have been only about a dozen disputes that have been raised to the administrator's level, but there have been a dozen, right? So it does happen. It's not that common, but sometimes it does happen. Next slide, please. So to put this all together, you've heard this from Emmy and you've heard this from me, you know, check to the language, adhere to those timelines to the extent you can, but sometimes you can't, right? There may be circumstances that change. Someone's on vacation, someone's away, and there's delays. Sometimes parties like to, you know, it's 21 days and you really think that if you talk for one more meeting, you can get that resolution and you don't have to elevate it to the next step. That may be appropriate, right? The catch is if it's just one more meeting, just one more meeting, just one more meeting for a year, you probably, misjudged that. But so timeline, right, it's generally 21 days. Check your FFA for details. Next slide, please. So here are some formal dispute examples. These are very general, and I think we're not gonna get into the specifics of them, but just to give you an idea, and I know Emmy provided some before, formal dispute over MCLSS cleanup levels, right? There may be an argument over whether or not groundwater is a potential source of drinking water. If it is, maybe the one party says, you gotta restore that aquifer to drinking water levels. If it's not, maybe you don't. So that could have a big impact. You can have a request for extension to deadlines. Hey, we need more time for X reason. And the other party may say, you know, the FFA has a clause on what's good cause, and we don't think that this falls into it. Now we don't agree. Third, and I think Emmy hinted at this one too, disagreement over ARRs happens all the time, right? It's part of our discussions, which ARRs should be in a ROD. And as Emmy said, and as John said, if you see a problem like this coming, it's very often to everyone's benefit to work it out. That site that Emmy mentioned where there's a standing meeting to talk about things coming down that might be issues later, great. You know, if you can avoid the anything stopping work, anything causing delays, great. Next slide, please. So I want to talk before I introduce our guest a little bit about the role of states. So states can play a role, of course, in the dispute resolution process. If they're a party to the FFA, they may invoke the dispute process themselves, right? That's something they're empowered to do. They may even be empowered to collect stipulated penalties depending on, you know, the circumstances, which has happened before. They can make EPA aware of issues, even if they are not involved in the FFA itself, they can raise stuff. And then the affected state is gonna be represented at each level of the dispute process, in a level corresponding to the other parties in the dispute. So with that, I wanna introduce our guest speaker. I'll get to her bio in just a moment, but I wanted to note that so far in this presentation, you've heard from a bunch of us who all work at EPA and we all work at EPA headquarters. And so we've talked about things from a general overview perspective. We thought it would be useful to have a different voice so that you're not just hearing from us and not just hearing from DC to talk about their own experience with disputes. So with that, I'm very pleased to introduce Susan Fulmer. She's from the South Carolina Department of Health and Environmental Control. Susan has over 19 years of experience with the state government, and she's a registered professional geologist in South Carolina. And then most importantly for today's conversation, she is South Carolina State's Federal Facilities Manager for the Savannah River site. So we're grateful to have her today. Thank you for joining us, Susan, and over to you.
Thanks, Logan. Good afternoon, everybody. I'm going to spend a few minutes discussing how the state, EPA, and Department of Energy have handled disputes at the Savannah River site on the high-level waste tanks. So this is one of the examples that Logan gave of examples of disputes. Ours were on milestones that we did not agree on. So let me jump into it and first give you a little bit of background on the Savannah River site and the high-level waste tank system. So SRS is located 20 miles south of Aiken, South Carolina. It occupies about 110 square miles of land adjacent to the Savannah River, and it borders Georgia with Augusta, Georgia being approximately 25 miles to the northwest. So SRS was constructed during the early 1950s to produce basic materials in support of our nation's defense programs for fabrication of nuclear weapons, primarily tritium and plutonium-239, and then also for research and medical programs. So there are five reactors at the site, and a number of support facilities were built to produce these materials. SRS was placed on the national priority list in 1989, and in 1993, DOE, EPA, and DHEC entered into an interagency agreement, RFFA, and it integrates the CERCLA response action process with the corrective measures provisions of RCRA. So to date, we've cleaned up 420 of the 515 waste units at the site. They're either complete or they're in a remediation phase. A little background on the high-level waste tanks. So the high-level radioactive liquid waste is generated by SRS as byproducts from the processing of nuclear materials. So the waste totals about 35 million gallons, and it's currently stored in 43 underground carbon steel waste tanks that are grouped into two tank farm areas on the site. There are 24 of these tanks that are considered old style and do not have any kind of secondary containment. And 8 of the old style tanks have identified leak sites, with 6 of those located in the water table. So obviously a risk. To date, we have 8 additional old style tanks that have been closed out. So South Carolina, the state, considers the high-level waste tanks to be the greatest risk to human health and the environment in the state. We regulate the tanks under the South Carolina Pollution Control Act through a state industrial wastewater permit. However, there are milestones that are set in our FFA for certain activities associated with the tanks, such as bulk waste removal and tank closure activities. So the tanks will operate through the wastewater permit, and then closure is conducted in a wastewater closure plan. And once the tank is closed out, emptied, grouted out, it exits the wastewater permit, and the tanks would be addressed through our FFA process for any needed soil and groundwater remediation that's required. Okay, so let's talk about those disputes. In March of 2006, DOE requested an extension for the regulatory closure dates for 2 of our high-level waste tanks. DHEC did not agree to this request and issued a non-concurrence, and dispute was invoked as a result. DOE, EPA, and South Carolina are all equal partners in our federal facility agreement, so any one of the parties could have invoked dispute. In October of 2007, our dispute was elevated to the Dispute Resolution Committee. So we talked about this a lot earlier in the webinar. Informal dispute is fine if you can make progress, but we spent a year and a half in informal dispute. And so, you know, if you can make progress, great, but it's important to recognize when you are not making progress and it's time to elevate the dispute to the next level. So that's what we did. We elevated to the DRC, and 28 days later, which is the timeframe that's specified in our FFA, the dispute was resolved. Okay, as part of the dispute resolution, bulk waste removal and operational closure dates for each of the remaining tanks were created and documented in an appendix to our FFA. It created an aggressive schedule with the idea that a new treatment facility known as the Salt Waste Processing Facility, or SWPF, would be in operation in 2011, and that treatment facility would allow SRS to be able to close those tanks on a quicker schedule. The agreement that we came up with also detailed the requirement of an annual report on various tank closure activities, and the agreement memorialized a formal commitment for DOE to involve the state and EPA throughout each stage of our bulk waste and heel removal process by conducting frequent informal meetings or conference calls. And as a result, we began holding quarterly calls where DOE would explain the removal and treatment activities that they undertook each quarter. They would discuss the results of any removal operations that they conducted, the challenges they encountered, and the next steps that they had planned in meeting the objectives of treating the high-level waste and closing the tanks out. So we still have these meetings today, and they have been extremely valuable in developing a common understanding among the three parties. So let's fast forward a few years. Due to the delay in startup of the salt waste processing facility and some other technical and programmatic issues, DOE requested additional extensions for bulk waste removal and tank closure milestones. The first extension request was in 2014, the second in 2016. And as a result, the three parties entered into two additional disputes. So, we spent 3 months in informal dispute as a result of the 2014 extension request. It's a much better time frame than our previous informal dispute. We recognized that the issues, again, could not be resolved at the informal level, and so the state requested that the dispute be elevated to the DRC in January of 2015. So the DRC was able to partially resolve the dispute within 28 days. And the remaining issue was elevated to the senior executive committee. And I want to, again, kind of just pause here and point out, you know, you can work to resolve as many issues as possible at a lower level, but not everything needs to be elevated, okay? But it's important to recognize that there are some issues that only upper management can negotiate. And when that's the case, which was as it was here, it is totally appropriate to elevate part of the dispute. So for the remaining issue of the dispute, our SEC was able to resolve it in 46 days. Now, this exceeds the 28-day timeframe that is stated in our FFA, but this additional time was needed just because it was difficult to find a time when the three parties were able to sit down and meet. Remember, this is top-level management when you're at the SEC level. So in this case, it was the site manager at DOE, the regional administrator for EPA, and it was the director of environmental affairs for the state of South Carolina. So once the SEC was able to sit down together, they met in person and they resolved the issue within just a few hours. And now the 2016 dispute. So DOE requested an extension to a bulk waste removal milestone in June of 2016. And again, that extension request was not approved by the state of South Carolina or by EPA. So in July, DOE was the one to invoke informal dispute. The dispute was resolved at the informal level in this case. It lasted 6 months, and the three parties held three technical information exchange meetings. We held them in person. Of course, this was all pre-COVID, and DOE began providing monthly tracking report to demonstrate their progress to us and meeting the milestones in question. So as part of the informal dispute resolution, both EPA and DHEC required DOE to continue to submit the monthly tracker and also to commit to two additional meetings to discuss some larger programmatic issues that they had. So the idea behind the commitment for additional meetings, even after we resolved the dispute, was the common understanding between the three parties that Department of Energy had some larger technical and programmatic issues that would prevent them from achieving the milestones that were originally agreed to back in 2007. So we knew that another milestone was going to be coming up the next year, 2017, and it was going to be very unlikely that Department of Energy could meet that milestone. And the three parties did not want to continue going into dispute, but we wanted to hold DHEC and EPA wanted to hold DOE to their commitments and work through the issues. And so this was a way to try to avoid going in dispute. All right, so let's talk about our new approach. In 2017, again, DOE requested another extension for the bulk waste removal and efforts and operational closure of tanks. All the parties agreed that the aggressive tank closures, aggressive tank closure schedule was not achievable and there needed to be renegotiated. But we knew that there were issues that remained that prevented us from resetting the milestones to realistic, achievable dates. So while the state recognized that the extension would be needed, we didn't believe simply extending the milestone would be adequate. So the state wanted to see Department of Energy commit to implementing some risk reduction at the site, even if it was within an area other than the tank farms. So rather than entering a dispute again, DOE, EPA, and DHEC agreed to suspend the 2017 and the 2018 tank milestones while furthering our shared interest in continuing risk reduction efforts at the site. So EPA and DHEC requested that DOE look at activities outside of the tank farms. DOE agreed to accelerate two soil and groundwater projects in another area of the site that's outside of the tank farms. They also agreed to maintain a good faith effort to advance the SRS radioactive liquid waste system. And they were going to do that by accelerating some of the closure activities in one of the tank farm areas. So these activities would further reduce risk site-wide, and that was good and happy. You know, EPA and DHEC were pleased with the projects that DOE had proposed. And so in exchange, the milestones were temporarily suspended rather than extended pending startup of the salt waste processing facility and resolution of some other programmatic issues that we had. So to show each agency's commitment behind this agreement, it was signed by our DRC, even though we were not in a formal dispute at this time, but we wanted to show that it had the support of upper management in the agency. The agreement was later extended in 2019 with some additional risk reduction commitments that were created by DOE. So where are we today? Okay, the accelerated projects that they committed to are ongoing, and milestones for those accelerated projects were placed into the FFA. The regulators remain in constant communication with DOE regarding the activities that occur at the liquid waste program. And in 2020, the salt waste processing facility began hot commissioning with hot operations starting in January of 2021. So that facility is up and running now and is able to process the radioactive waste out of the tanks and help us clean them out and get us closer to those closure goals that we were looking for. In November of 2021, Department of Energy also awarded their liquid waste integrated mission completion contract. And so with both of these key achievements in place, SWPF and the new contract in place, the three parties are now able to sit down together. We're in the right position where we can renegotiate the tank milestones to a realistic schedule. In fact, we have, in accordance with our suspension agreement, we've held our first negotiation meeting that was held at the end of last year. And we are underway with our negotiations, and we have committed to a goal. We've set a goal to complete negotiations by the end of September of 2022. So I'll just wrap up with a few takeaways. And these are things that you've already heard from our other speakers so far. But I think they're good points to emphasize and some things that we used in our program here. So first, Again, it's extremely important that all of the parties make a good faith effort to resolve the dispute. And hopefully that can be achieved at the informal level. But, you know, if progress isn't being made, it is entirely appropriate to elevate the dispute to whatever level is needed to reach the agreement. And that's what we did in several of the cases. Again, know your FFA's dispute resolution timeframes and stick to them. We had some long informal disputes, but we did elevate when we needed to. And having those timeframes in the FFA, sometimes, you know, just a deadline is the only motivation that you really need to reach an agreement. Also remember to, of course, look for common ground and use that as a starting point when you're looking for a framework to establish your resolution. And of course, be creative when looking for options to satisfy everyone. You know, we were very focused on the tank farms and the risk reduction there, but in the end, the agreements that we came to did some risk reduction outside of those areas. And that was a win-win for everyone. And then of course, finally, remember that, you know, the devil's in the details. Once you have your agreement, don't make assumptions that everyone knows and understands and will remember what was agreed to. You've got to be very clear about the specifics of your resolution so that there aren't any questions or objections later on in the process. And with that, I will pause and see if there are any questions for me.
All right, thank you. There, I believe, were a handful of questions that came in, but I think many of them are directed at our other presenters today. So I just wanted to confirm with the audience, if you have any questions specifically for Susan, now is a great time to go ahead and put those in the Q&A space. If you don't have any specific questions on her perspective or the case study, you can put in no questions for Susan in the Q&A and that'll help. And then we'll know that we can use our time to move on to other elements and then go back to some of those other questions that came in earlier. And remember, ladies and gentlemen, I know doing online training can be sometimes a bit difficult, but remember, if I'm asking you to put in no questions, I'm actually talking to you. If you can hear my voice, I mean you, that it never hurts to give me an affirmative or a negative response either way, just confirming that we can move on to other components and then open up to more general questions. And from what I'm seeing coming in now, and a great big thank you to everyone. Susan, I see no specific questions for your case study, but a number of thank yous for the time and information you shared on that site. But I'll ask with you to stay with us because there might be some questions or comments that'll come in later on for you.
Absolutely. And again, there's my contact information. If there aren't questions today, you think of something later, feel free to reach out to me, but I'll hang on the line.
All right. So I think I'll turn it back to Emmy and team to carry on with the presentation.
All right. Looks like it's me, Emmy, and feel free to jump in. This is just to conclude us today, and then, you know, we can deal with any questions that we might have after. You know, as always, and as Susan so wonderfully summarized at the end too, right? Read your FFA, start there, make sure you're prepared to handle disagreement. As always, move on to formal dispute if substantive progress is not being made. And then at the end, celebrate agreement, right? This is all about cleaning up these sites. And anytime we move forward on that, that's great. So that is a wonderful thing. And even when we don't agree, if we can move the site forward, that's fantastic. So always remember to keep that in mind. I think that concludes our presentation as well. So there's our contact information for John, Emmy, and me. If you have questions, I think we can go to those, Jean, and we can put Emmy back on the spotlight as well and go from there.
All right, excellent. So I am gonna start reading some of these here and try to group them in topic area. And I'll just remind the audience, we do have plenty of time for Q&A, so you can continue to type in your questions and comments for our speakers as I start reading through ones that came in earlier. So this first question is looking to confirm earlier, and I believe, Logan, it might be directed at you. Can you confirm that EPA ultimately makes the decision in a dispute resolution when it's elevated to the highest level?
Yes, yes. So that is both statutory in CERCLA 120 and in our FFA process. So the administrator of EPA, that's it's specifically the administrator, is the final authority on disputes. Okay. So if it truly has not been resolved, right? And like I said, most of the time they do resolve before that. But if it doesn't, that is the final authority, yeah.
Okay. Can you tell me, are FFAs legally binding?
Yes. So these are agreements that all the parties who sign them have agreed to. They can be enforced. They can be, sometimes, as I mentioned, there are stipulated penalties that could be associated with. So there could be actual penalties that you've agreed to pay. You know, your agency may have agreed to pay to others if they violate the FFA. So yes.
Okay. Does EPA have final authority in BRAC, B-R-A-C sites as well?
I think we're going to defer on that one. Okay. There's going to be some nuances there. Put a pause on that one.
It, definitely at the MPL sites, EPA plays that role, but BRAC gets a little different.
Okay. Gotcha. Okay.
Yeah, that's fine.
Let's take a question here for five-year reviews. Should the FFA dispute resolution process be invoked if the federal lead agency disagrees with EPA's independent findings? So this is a non-concurrent situation on a five-year review. They just really wanted to know, is there a separate dispute resolution process for five-year reviews?
So I can jump in on that one. When it comes to five-year reviews, the lead agency is responsible for issuing those five-year reviews, and they put in their their conclusions, essentially. Check your FFA. It will say whether or not EPA has a role in reviewing that five-year review officially. Typically, we do review them. However, if EPA issues a letter of non-concurrence for your five-year review determinations at your site, that is the final decision. There is no process to dispute that EPA decision of non-concurrence.
Okay. Let's go back to timelines, shall we? So there are a couple of questions that correlate or correspond to the timelines and various timetables. So this first question, in general, efforts to resolve a, quote, informal dispute will take more than 30 days. So they're asking, how is the, quote, 30 days rule applied if the informal dispute for a draft final document lasts more than 30 days, and then we finally decide to elevate to a formal dispute?
So I can take that one. And again, I'm going to have to speak in generalities because your site, your circumstances, your FFA may be different. But generally, the FFAs are going to contain a clause that says, you know, within 30 days, any action that generates a dispute. So there may be, there's an example. There may be an action that is still ripe. But I also think there are occasions when this takes longer, and I would refer you in those cases to your local counsel, right? Whether it's your agency's counsel or your office. It's just there's too many complicating factors there. Emmy, do you have anything to add?
So I would just say that, you know, Logan mentioned, try to adhere to these timelines. I will also acknowledge we have had formal disputes take 3 to 7 years to be fully resolved, entirely outside of the timelines recommended in the FFAs. So again, we strive to resolve these issues, you know, quickly, but sometimes the government doesn't move that fast, and it can take much longer than what's in your FFA.
Yeah, and the only other thing I'm thinking of right now is that principal's memo that I mentioned does lay out for EPA, first of all, you know, that's a principal's memo from the OLM and the OECA AAs. Refer to that, review that. And it's an attempt, I think, to provide some clarity to this question, right? There are circumstances that do take longer, and then there are others that don't. So I would refer you to that. The link is in your student manual, right? So if you go to this slide and you go to the bottom of this slide, you can just click it and it'll get you right to that principal's memo. And I think that should help.
Okay. What happens if after 21 days, you fail to elevate within 7 days?
So these are, I get the these types of questions. So the terms that you have agreed to with the other parties are the terms that your office, your agency, the other agencies, this is generally, again, what has been agreed to. You know, if the parties have no objection, that's kind of an issue for them to decide. There is one on the regional administrator, right? Once that decision is reduced to writing and is finalized, there is a clause that's a timeout that's 14 days or it becomes, that's provided for in the FFAs, it becomes the final decision. The others, you know, that is an issue for the parties to go over.
I mean, generally, if there's agreement, we're going to take so many extra days, months, weeks to resolve, then no one's going to try and take an action against not following those timelines, right? So sometimes the groups agree we need more time to work on this.
Okay.
Yeah. Thanks, Emmy.
Okay. So this one may not have an answer, but I'm going to ask it. Why does the RA, which I believe they're referencing regional administrator, not have a set amount of days to respond?
So this is where check your own FFA comes in to make sure that they don't, in fact, have a timeline in there. This is the one I used as an example. It's probably based off, as I mentioned, the Fort Eustis model, if I'm remembering correctly. And that one, for whatever reason, I think did not. I would have to go back and confirm. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it really depends on your FFA. And I think Susan had mentioned that the timelines in some of hers were a little bit different, right? They might be a longer period or something like that. So yeah, see your FFA for details.
Okay. All right. Can a state agency invoke a dispute resolution?
So I can take that one. I mean, if the state's a party, then the state has all the abilities and rights that the agreement gives to the people who are parties. So if the state's a party to the FFA and the FFA says anybody can invoke a dispute for whatever, you know, for these reasons, then the state can use that as well. If the state's not a party, it might be a little bit more complicated. But as I mentioned, the state can certainly go to the parties and say, you know, we have this concern, we have this issue, we have this problem. So it can depend. But if the state is part of the agreement, then the state is part of the agreement.
Okay. And I apologize. I may have a bit of a background sound here coming on my end, but we're going to go here to our next question. And somebody commented that their particular site, they had another federal agency who issued their own protectiveness determination in the final 5-year report. And then EPA issued an independent finding of protectiveness. Can you comment on that scenario where another federal agency does their own protectiveness determination, but then EPA does that independent finding of protectiveness?
Absolutely. Yeah, I'm going to defer to Emmy on that one.
Yeah. So I use the term non-concurrence, but I'll use independent finding. That's actually the more correct term. So your lead agency at your federal facility at an NPL site is going to issue their 5-year review as if required for decision documents at the site. In that document, hopefully EPA and the state regulators have had a chance to review, provide input or feedback. However, in that final version that's put out, it doesn't require necessarily EPA or state concurrence. That is the lead agency's issuance of a 5-year review with their protectiveness determinations for each cleanup decision at the site. If EPA does not agree with any of the protectiveness statements in that document, EPA can decide to write its own independent finding of protectiveness letter that officially states EPA does not agree with this finding at this OU, and that goes into the record. Essentially, that is something that gets reported to Congress, so EPA goes on record where we do not agree with protectiveness statements. And as I mentioned before, there's no dispute resolution process on that 5-year review. I hope that clarified the question.
Okay. Basic question here. Do all sites have an FFA?
I can take that one. So CERCLA 120, if you have a federal facility site, CERCLA section 120 is going to require you to enter into an interagency agreement with EPA and the parties to govern the site's cleanup. We don't see new sites that often. So by now, generally speaking, and always with those potential for exceptions, yeah, every site has an FFA that governs its cleanup. That's of course for federal facilities, right? So private sites, totally different world. That's not what we're talking about today. A brand new site or something newly added, different circumstance, but you can check CERCLA 120 It does lay out a directive that all sites shall enter into an interagency agreement on this.
Okay. We had a comment here, and this came in earlier when we were talking about partnership and communication. So one of the attendees noted that formal restoration partnering, as practiced in some regions, will actually go so far as to incorporate protocols that make collaboration sustainable over time, especially considering factors like staffing changes. So I myself had not heard the phrase formal restoration partnering before. So I don't know if you have heard that and can talk a little bit about that.
Sure. So partnering, I know for EPA, Region 3 is very big on partnering and has had a lot of success in collaborating together with the other federal agency partners on cleanup at federal facility sites through that approach. So again, having a plan on how you're going to deal with disagreements and being able to work them in a way that issues get resolved quickly. So partnering, again, that has been really successful at Region 3. And I know for the Federal Facilities Program, we're looking for lessons learned to potentially help take those best management practices to other regions that maybe don't have as big of a focus on that approach.
Okay. We are in the federal agency and in the federal world, and so we have acronym CITI going on. So I'm going to read this one out slow because I think there's maybe two words, but 10 acronyms. So here we go. So the question is asking, do DSMOA, i.e., or for example, FUDS or FUDS or BRAC, B-R-A-C sites also all have FFAs?
So Emmy, if you have stuff to add on this, let's go to you. But to first, I can say, you know, these, if I'm remembering correctly, there can be sites that are both FFAs under cleanups that are also DSMOA or FUD sites. But let's go to Emmy and see if you have anything to add. There, as far as I'm aware, there's not a separate, you know, to answer that part of the question, there's not a separate like DSMOA process or anything like that. But you could have some here. Does that sound right, Emmy?
So we're DSMOA, we're talking about the Defense and State Memorandum of Agreement that you'll have at some sites, really meant to expedite environmental restoration at our Department of Defense sites. But as far as there'll be a legal agreement that captures the roles and responsibilities of each party involved, but I don't believe it's officially referred to as an FFA, unless I'm misunderstanding the question. Was that what you were getting at, Logan?
I was thinking that they may not be mutually exclusive. Like there's an FFA process, yes, for all our FFA sites, on the NPL, et cetera. And they may be, so FUDs, formerly used defense site, right? They may be a FUD site, et cetera. But I'm not aware of like a separate, like this is for FUDs and this is for not FUDs.
Okay. All right. I think we've gone through most of the questions, although we did have one of the earlier questioners respond, and thank you for commenting on their question. They went on and clarified that for their sites, they wound up invoking an informal dispute under the additional work provisions of their FFA to compel performance of the work necessary to resolve five-year review deficiencies that were identified. And those were what ultimately formed the basis of their independent finding of protectiveness. So I don't know if you've been in that situation or have anything to add to that comment.
I think I would just say great use of looking at provisions in your FFA and using them to ensure you're getting the best information to make cleanup decisions at your site. That's why you should read it and know all the clauses it entails.
Okay. So I do want to circle back to the question that was brought up earlier, and I want to be sure that we've had a chance to discuss it. So earlier, one of the attendees had asked, would an example of a lead federal agency dispute be where you have an NPL site that EPA adopts its decision over the, and I think that they mean lead agency's decision. So I don't know if you want to respond on that example. So if you have an NPL site, EPA adopts its decision over the agency's decision. Is that an example of a lead federal agency dispute?
Yeah, so I'm not sure I exactly follow with the adoption of a decision from EPA. Okay. I'm trying to think of how that would work. If it's about the five-year review, you know, Emmy has spoken to that. If it's about the rod itself, that's kind of different. So I'm sorry to say, I don't quite follow. Emmy, do you have any thoughts?
I'm not sure if the question is asking with remedy selection, if it would be a dispute if EPA decided that they would select a remedy different than what was identified by the lead agency as a preferred alternative in the proposed plan. Hopefully it wouldn't get to that point, and that could get resolved sooner than to that point in the CERCLA process. So
in that case, so then I would direct people to CERCLA 120E4, which explains that in the event of a dispute over remedy, the EPA administrator decides. So that one is provided for in statute, if that's the direction this question's going. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I don't see any other questions currently in the Q&A window, so I'll just again call to the audience. If you have no questions, please feel free to type in no questions into the Q&A. If you do, now is your last chance to type them in before we move on to closing reminders. And speaking of that, I'm seeing a few more come in here. So,
oh boy. Jean, could you flip to our contact information too? Because sure. if we do have items that are too specific or stuff that needs individual follow-up or people remember later, that'd be fine.
Okay. All right. Well, we did have one clarifying question. So one of the attendees wanted to know if those DESMOA or DSMOA and FUDS, FUDS sites are required to have FFAs. They didn't fully understand.
Let's follow up on that one individually, because now I'm not sure.
Okay. All right. So to that questioner, we will direct them to reach out to you or one of the speakers directly by email, and your contact info is shown on this slide.
That'd be great.
All right. And then we just had a comment in case this helps anyone else out there. One of the attendees noted that in their region for their DoD sites, there are also restoration partnering meetings, and they have FUDs and USACE attendees, DoD services, state and EPA representatives. So they have a huge range of attendees, and they do discuss DESMOA sometimes at those meetings. So just a comment from another attendee. With that, the bulk of what I'm seeing in here is a lot of no questions, no questions. But one last one here. In a case where EPA does not concur with a five-year review protectiveness determination, what does that do? Does it have an effect going forward?
So one thing I mentioned, when EPA issues that independent finding of protectiveness on a five-year review that the lead agency has finalized and made available to the public, that gets reported back to Congress, and nobody wants a bad report card going home to mom and dad, right? Or whatever, what have you. So that is where you don't, typically the lead agency doesn't want that mark against them or that formal acknowledgement that EPA disagrees that what they're saying is protective, is actually protective. That could raise a lot of public interest or concerns. If the agency saying, the lead agency saying, well, everything's fine, and EPA is saying, actually, no, we don't think it is. So that is a big reason to try and work together in the draft of the five-year review and try and get to agreement there. But I've seen where EPA and the lead agency just do not agree, are not going to agree. Lead agency issues their document and EPA says, well, this is what we think. And again, there's no dispute resolution process there for the five-year review. And that, again, gets reported back to Congress.
Okay. Okay. And then I do want to just chime in with a comment from one of your previous presenters, Emmy, from the Federal Facilities Office. Monica McKeady is on, and she just shared a clarifying comment where she said, if the site is on the NPL, then it should have an FFA. So if it is a FUD site, and it is on the NPL, then there should be an FFA. So thank you, Monica.
Another way of saying that, if it's a non-NPL site, then there isn't a requirement for a federal facilities agreement. Is that right, Logan?
Yeah, exactly.
All right.
Yeah, and actually, thank you, Monica, for that. I think that's the word I was looking for. You know, it's for our federal facilities sites, it comes down to ownership and site control, right? These are not privately owned sites. These are going to be sites owned by the federal government being cleaned up through FFA agreements. So you can have FUD sites in all sorts of different circumstances. Some are on the NPL, and I would imagine some are not. Thanks, Monica, for adding that in.
All right. Well, Emmy and Logan, and to our other presenters, if there are any final thoughts, now is the time, and then otherwise I will carry on with our closing instructions.
I think we're good. Thank you so much. Thanks to Susan for joining. Thanks, everybody.
All right. Well, with that, let me call up our presentation materials here from the beginning, and I'll go through a final set of closing reminders as we get ready to end our session today. So just in case you joined us a bit late, I wanted to remind everybody that this webinar is part of the ongoing Federal Facilities Online Academy, which is composed of 12 courses total. There will be 11 webinars that are hosted online on Cluin. So we've just completed our June delivery, which I believe is the fifth session, which means that we have six more to go. There'll be one per month through the remainder of the calendar year. And then there is an in-person three-day classroom delivery, which is currently scheduled later in the summer. So it'll be taking place, I believe, in June, but that is open to a limited audience. Only EPA states, federal agencies, and tribes may participate, but these 11 webinars are open to the public. So remember, you can get a participation certificate documenting your attendance in any of the online webinars that we're doing through Cluin, whether you're here live or you replay the recorded versions. And then if you're able to do all 11 webinars and get in and participate in that three-day classroom training, you'll also receive a Academy certificate for completing the entire suite of 12 classes. So if you have any questions on these, you can feel free to reach out to myself or Emmy. We'll be happy to clarify the Academy sessions. So the other reminder that I did want to provide is that I encourage you to connect with us on the Cleanup Information Network at cluin.org. We have a variety of listservs, RSS feeds, podcasts, and probably our most popular item is our free monthly newsletter, Tech Direct, which I send out on the first of each month. So if you haven't added yourself, I encourage you to subscribe to that newsletter, and you can find out about sessions like today's webinar for free each month. For those of you who are looking for copies of the presentation materials, we have a seminar homepage. It is the red URL listed on the top of this slide. The website is open from today forward. So you can bookmark that website. You can share it with colleagues. There'll be a series of sections. You might need to look for plus and minus sides along the side to expand or collapse sections, but you'll find areas where we've posted the presentation materials. And in this case, you'll want to download something called the Student Manual, which is a collection of the presentation materials plus additional detailed notes. We've already posted that there, along with contact information for our presenters. And on that homepage, you'll find a link to our feedback form, which, if you would like to get a participation certificate, you'll need to fill out that online feedback form. So if you follow the link to the feedback form and you fill it out, making sure that you check the box at the bottom of the form certifying you were here for the entire session, as soon as you submit your feedback, you'll then have access to download or print out a participation certificate for the webinar on the screen. We'll also try to email a copy of that to you, but sometimes those get caught up by junk or spam filters. So I encourage you to download or save the copy that shows up on the confirmation screen. If you happen to be back in the office and have colleagues joining you at your location to watch the session, I'd ask that you share the link to the feedback form with them as well. They can fill it out on their own and get their own participation certificate, even if they didn't register independently for the session. And if you happen to be one of the lucky people that is replaying the recorded version of today's webinar, you can still visit that homepage to fill out the feedback form and get your own participation certificate. And right about now, just above my head in the upper right corner in the archive version of the webinar, there should be a button or link right over to that feedback form that you can connect and use it to open it up. And if you don't, again, just visit the URL shown here on red. We'll get an email out to you all in about 1 week when the archived version is available for on-demand playback. With that, I want to thank all of our presenters and organizers who shared their expertise and helped to pull off today's session. I also want to thank our numerous support staff in the background who helped to support the live event. And I want to thank all of you who joined us from across the United States for today's session. We hope that this was a valuable expenditure of your time and that you will continue to join us on a future Cluin webinar. With that, I'll formally conclude today's live broadcast.